Hi, my name is Ruth, and I am an alcoholic. And, you know, just be like the rest of you. I didn't realize at the time that I was comparing my messed up insides to all of your put together in outside, and that all of us feel that way inside. And so when I was growing up in Wisconsin, and when I first was old enough to make a conscious decision to drink alcohol and I poured it in my system, for the first time in a long time, I felt good enough, smart enough, and pretty enough. And I thought that that was the answer, you know. I was pretty much, my alcoholism progressed pretty quickly, it was pretty quick for me. From the beginning, I drank until I got sick. I drank until I blacked out, and I drank until I passed out, you know. And it was pretty constant, and it was, I thought I was drinking like everybody else that I was drinking with, but they were not experiencing some of the problems I was experiencing. Either the blanks they were filling in, because I couldn't remember, and they could, were not really, maybe they couldn't remember either, but I seemed to be the only one that just had large hours of time where I could not remember what I was doing. And like all of us, those large blocks of time can get you into trouble if you're still walking, you know. And I got into quite a bit of trouble. I won't spend a lot of time on that, but I did get myself into quite a bit of trouble. And I was pretty young because I was growing up in Wisconsin, and the drinking age at that time was 18. And so when I was a senior in high school, I could legally drink. And I forgot to mention, and I guess I'll go ahead and mention it now, through the grace of God and living these steps, the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, I have been sober since September 18th, 1986. I got sober, and I remained sober from 21. I got sober when I was 21. And, probably the one person I hurt the most in my drinking was my mom. She, of course, was very worried about me. There would be nights where I didn't even come home. And she would stay up all night waiting for me to come home, and I didn't even bother to call or anything. I actually didn't even think about it, you know. And she would stay up all night waiting for me to come home, and then she'd go to work the next morning after no nights of sleep, you know. Many of time when I was getting sick, she was there holding had a wastebasket in my bedroom. I can still picture it. She was holding that wastebasket or holding back my hair or just, you know, and I don't know. We don't really think about it until after we get sober, the people we're hurting by what we're doing. We think we're hurting nobody but ourselves. And I'll never forget, you know, her doing that. And she stood by me with a lot of the trouble I got into, too. You know, she held my hand and she helped me walk through some of the trouble I had caused and some of the trouble I had caused my family. And, it's an incredible thing that the alcoholics seem to be born into families that do that for us, you know. Or you hear stories, some of us marry people that are very supportive. And she was one of those people. And, I don't know, maybe if I'd continued drinking, maybe she would have needed Al-Anon at some point, or maybe somebody would have called her a codependent, I don't know, but she was my mom, and she did the best she could, and she was taking care of me when I couldn't take care of myself. The summer before my senior year of college, I decided to stay. I was going to college about 30 miles away from home, and I decided to stay was a small town in Minnesota, and I decided to stay in Minnesota for that summer and take some summer school classes and just kind of, well, party. And my boyfriend at the time and I took a speech class. And the first day of the class, the professor walked into the room and he said, he wrote his name on the board, he wrote his phone number on the board, and he said, "My name is Rick Hudson and I'm an alcoholic. And if any of you are having trouble with your drinking, please call me." About 3 weeks later, I was with that boyfriend, and I was very unhappy. I was very miserable. And the alcohol wasn't making me feel pretty enough, good enough, and smart enough anymore. It just was not working anymore. It just wasn't working anymore. And I was a passenger in his car. I was with my boyfriend, and I was a passenger in his car. And we were on a, for lack of a better word, we were driving down a cliff. We were driving down it's called in Minnesota a bluff. It's not as big as a mountain. It's not as small as a hill. It's a bluff. And we were driving down the bluff, and we were fighting, and the road kind of curves to the right, and I leaned over from the passenger side because I couldn't go on living the way I was living, and I knew that. But I didn't know any other way to live. So I tried to turn the steering wheel left. And the driver of the car he managed to make sure the car stayed right. And, I don't know. I just was desperate, and I didn't know what else to do. And he didn't know what to do with me at that point, so he took me to the hospital, to the emergency room, and they didn't know what to do with me because I was pretty drunk. I was pretty belligerent. I was, And so they ended up transporting me by ambulance to my hometown. And they admitted me to the psych ward at the hospital that my mother worked at. And, one more time, there she was. You know, she didn't talk about being ashamed, and she didn't talk about being embarrassed by me, but the hell I would have been, you know. So I was there for a few days, and that was my pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, seeing my mom, you know, seeing me like that. I had to be fitted for my sister's. I was at my sister's wedding the following weekend, and I had to be fitted for the maid of honor dress on the psych ward, you know. Jamie, you know. So there I was. They kept me for a couple of days, and they released me from the hospital with a prescription of antabuse, and they told me that I was an alcoholic and I shouldn't drink anymore. Well, okay, that's not enough tools for me to stay sober. This is not going to cut it for me. So my mom wanted me to come home, and I wanted to go back to school. So my boyfriend drove to my hometown, picked me up, and brought me back to school. And in the car on the way home, he said to me, "So now what?" And I said, "As soon as you get me home, I'm going to call Rick." And I called that speech professor as soon as I got back to where I was going to school. And it just so happened to be a Monday. And he said to me, "There happens to be a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous tonight, this afternoon, on campus." And it was a group of college students. And that definitely this was a program of attraction rather than promotion, because for somebody like me, I can't imagine a better place to walk into AA, because I was a college student. And I had some preconceived notions of what Alcoholics Anonymous was. And it wasn't a bunch of college students, that's for sure. So he said he would take me to that meeting, but that he wouldn't stay. He said, I'll take you in, I'll introduce you to some people, and then I'm going to leave. Because he was a professor at that college, and, you know, he just didn't feel comfortable attending that meeting. And so I did. I went to that meeting, and I felt very comfortable there. I was a little jittery, but I felt very comfortable. Now, I hadn't had a drink in a couple of days, but I wasn't sober. You know, I was a mess. So I went to that meeting, and I listened to what they were talking about. I tried to listen to what they were talking about, and I just was still comparing my insides to their outsides, you know. And I mean, I felt comfortable there, and they were all very welcoming. And I said, okay, well, I'll give this a shot, you know. I'll see. And when the meeting was over, I talked to a few of them. Even later, they, you know, we walked home together, and or they walked me home, I guess. And they told me there was a meeting Tuesday night, and that it was a big book meeting, which I didn't know what that meant. And they wanted me to go with them. So they came and picked me up, and we went to the big book meeting. And that meeting was a little less welcoming. I found out later it was the only meeting a week in that town. So the old-timers in that meeting were very protective of their meeting, and they were very protective of AA. And I thought they were just bastards, you know. There's no other word to say. And after the meeting, I was telling one of my college student sober friends that that's what I thought. And they said, well, that's the only meeting they can go to a week. And their sobriety for them is a life or death situation. And if you stick around, maybe you'll understand that sobriety is a life or death situation for us. And they want to talk about the big book, and they want to talk about recovery because in that meeting, because it's their one chance as a group to do it. And later I learned to respect that. So the next night was a Wednesday, and since they had already told me that there was no more meetings that week, I pretty much white-knuckled it on Wednesday. And I finally decided that I couldn't do this, that I wasn't going to be able to do this. I was obsessing about drinking so badly that I just decided that I was going to go drink. And I decided that I was going to bars. So I started walking to the bars, and it was dark, and I saw someone coming towards me, and this was God doing for me what I could not do for myself. The person coming towards me later became my sponsor. It was one of the women from the Monday meeting. Her name is Carol, and she was walking towards me, and I was walking this way, and she's like, Ruth, where are you going? And I'm like, you know, I just can't do this, Carol. I'm going drinking. And she goes, where? And I'm like, I'm walking to the bars. And she's like, you're walking away from the bars. And I was like, oh, okay. I, you know, was so out of it that I was walking away. And I believe that was God working in my life. And she became my sponsor. And one of the first things I heard in this program was don't make any major decisions in your first year of sobriety. And this was September. And the following day, I was planning on graduating from college. And the following August, I was planning on moving to California. And I told her that. And she said, well, you have to do your first 9 steps before you move. Because you cannot run away from your problems anymore if you're going to live the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. So Carol and I, we started working on my steps, and I got to my 4th step, and she said to me, well, you need to do your fourth step, and you need to be finished by this day, because the following day we are leaving for Sioux Falls, South Dakota, for an AA convention, and you and I are going together, and you're doing your 5th step on the way there. So that's how I did my 5th step. And as I was writing my fourth step, I knew she was going to be driving. So I thought, you know, I'll write it down, but I don't know if I'm going to tell her, you know. And that word thorough kept coming back and back in my mind, you know. And so I did write everything down that I could. I mean, you know, I was 21 years old, and a fearless and thorough moral inventory to a 21-year-old is a little different than a fearless and thorough moral inventory to a 25-year-old, to a 30-year-old, you know. So I did, and I did my fifth step with her, and it really is true what you say in the big book about just getting all of that off your shoulders. I was carrying it around inside of me still, and it was still making me sick. And it wasn't until I got it out of me and, I mean, prayed about it and told another human being about it that that I could actually just leave it behind me and go forward and get away from it and not have to have that be what defines me. Because I was still defining myself as not pretty enough and not good enough and not smart enough. And we got to the eastern side of Minnesota. We started out on the western side of Minnesota on the Mississippi River, and we drove all the way across the state. We got to the other side, and she pulled up into a park, and it had a lake. And she just pulled along the side, and she goes, "I want you to get your big book and get out of my car and read the part about where it talks about the fifth step and read the last paragraph of that." And it talks about how after having done this, you go be quiet for a while and go sit by yourself. And I got out of her car. I left my purse and I left my cigarettes and I left everything in her car, and I got out and stood by the lake. And it didn't even, I had no fear that she was going to, she drove away, but I knew in my heart that she was coming back. You know, I had this intense faith. I didn't, you know, and I've never had that kind of faith in anybody except for maybe my mother. And so I did. I sat quietly for an hour, and instead of thinking, is she coming back, is she coming back, is she coming back, I was praying the whole time. And it talks about how you review your work so far, and have you left anything out, because you're building a new foundation. And I prayed on all of that by myself at the side of this lake in a town I'd never been to, and I felt that I had. I felt that I was ready to move on. And so and she did. She came back. And we proceeded to go to a convention, and I had a very great time. And she continued to take me through the steps, and she did help me through my sixth and my seventh and my eighth and my ninth. And I made my amends to my mom and to my sister and to everybody that I had hurt during my drinking days. And I got on a plane on August 17th, 1987. Got on a plane and moved out to California. And I only knew one person in California, and he was a gentleman who wasn't in recovery but knew I was. He had known about all the problems I had gone through and all the pain I had caused, because he was one of my mom's dearest friends. And so he knew that I was trying to stay sober, and he told me that he would hook me up with somebody who would get me to meetings. And that woman's name was Mary. And the first night I was in California, she took me to a meeting. And it was a Cocaine Anonymous meeting. It wasn't an AA meeting. And they were too complicated for me. I needed simple. I needed, you know, just fast. That was about all I could do, you know. And so anyway, I was at a Cocaine Anonymous meeting, and she introduced me to a man by the name of Rick. And he had just celebrated a year of sobriety, and I was 1 month shy of a year. And she introduced me to this man, Mary, just, you know, down in L.A., I don't know if any of you are familiar with the program down there, but there are some people down there who just think it's all one program, you know. The second meeting she took me to was an Overeaters Anonymous meeting. And the third meeting she took me to was a Gamblers Anonymous meeting. And three strikes, you're out for me. So I continued to be her friend, but I asked her for Rick's phone number. And I called Rick. And he said, you know, I'm a member of Cocaine Anonymous, and I do all my service work for that 12-step program because they're such a young program. But I get all my recovery from AA, and I go to AA meetings. So he started taking me to AA meetings. And what am I doing this time? Oh, okay. So he started taking me to AA meetings. And he was real involved in service work, and I was real involved in service work. I was answering the hotlines for Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was secretary in meetings. I was cleaning ashtrays and washing coffee cups. And, yeah, I'm that old. And I was sponsoring people, and he was sponsoring people, and we were both working with our own sponsors. And we developed quite a strong friendship, Rick and I did. And in about December of that year, we both were answering the hotline at the same time, but in different offices in the same building. So I was finished with my shift, and he was finished with his shift. And I had this feeling inside of me that something was wrong at home. And I couldn't really put a finger on it. I just thought something was wrong at home. And quite frankly, I thought it was something was wrong with where I was living at the time, not home, my home. But he took me home. Rick took me home. And he, my job at this house, I was living there free room and board in exchange for babysitting their son and doing the dishes every night. And I did the dishes whether I ate dinner there or not. So it was about 12 o'clock at night or 12 o'clock the next morning, and there was a kitchen full of dishes. And Rick stayed and did the dishes with me. And as he was leaving, I was walking him out. There was a note on the refrigerator, and it said, Ruth, you need to call home as soon as possible. So Rick said, you better do it. So I called home, and it was 2 a.m. back home at that time. And they told me that my mom answered the phone, and she told me that my grandfather had a stroke, and that they didn't know if he was going to live. So Rick says to me, okay, go upstairs and pack your bag. I'll pick you up tomorrow morning. And I'll drop by your office, and we'll tell your boss you're heading out of town, and I'll get you to the airport. And so I got on that plane, and before I got on that plane, he took me to the airport. He waited for me. That was, you know, before 9/11, so they could wait at the boarding area with you. And so I got on I was getting ready to get on the plane, and Rick kissed me like he had never kissed me before, because we were only friends. And he told me he loved me, and he told me to be safe. And so I got on that plane going, I don't know what just happened. So I wasn't sure I was ready to make to get involved in a relationship with a man. He was sober. I was sober. We were working our own programs. I just wasn't really sure I was ready to get into a relationship with another, with a man sober. And I came home, my grandfather died, and I came home. I came back to California, and he was there at the airport waiting for me, and said nothing about, he said nothing about what had happened right before I got on the airplane, and Just a few weeks later, we were back at that airport because I was going home for Christmas, and he did the same damn thing. So that mid end, I still wasn't sure I was ready for that. So he didn't know this, but I was talking to my sponsor about it and everything. And about mid-January, we're sitting in an AA meeting, and we're sitting next to each other. And I just reached over and grabbed for his hand. And I guess that was my way of letting him know, okay, let's do this. And so we did. We ended up getting married. We got married in 1989. And we started living a sober life as a married couple. And we moved to Arroyo Grande and started a family because we did not want to raise children in Southern California. And we started a family, and he was working and I was working and did the whole thing. We bought the house, and all that. Probably wasn't one of our wisest financial decisions buying that house because it was a little bit... We got our financing like a lot of people did. We thought we were going to buy a house with this much of a payment, and they said, oh, no, we could finance you for this much, so we went for it. And so for a number of years, we struggled with that. And my husband was working out of town like three nights a week, and I was single mom to our son for those. And we just were not really living a very happy life. And I stopped going to AA meetings as a result of just feeling too pressured to pursue the American dream. And my employer at the time merged with a company in Visalia. And so I knew eventually I was probably going to be out of the job. And we had already talked about it, and we decided we were not moving to Visalia under any circumstances. Yes. That was our will. Once again, God was doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. My husband politely informed me. He said, I've been thinking about this. I'm like, really? What are you thinking? He's like, well, I could quit my job. We could sell this house. We could get out from under this pressure we're feeling and buy a house in Visalia. And I could start doing for us what I'm doing for somebody else and become self-employed. I'm like, We started thinking about it. And actually, it helped prevent probably a financial crisis for us. And that was God doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. In spite of the fact that we were going to AA meetings, we were praying, we were living the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, and we were getting sober. And in 2003, we decided to move to Visalia. And it turned out to be a perfect thing for us to do, although I wasn't sure about it at first. Our son at that time was 8 years old or so, and I was a little worried about moving my son. And he adapted very easily because what ended up happening was my husband quit his job and was unemployed for a couple of months. And I was okay with that. We were okay with that. I said, we're going to be together, and you're not going to be on the road as much, and we can get out of some of that, pressure. And so we did. And my husband did. He got real involved. My son played roller hockey, and so my husband and my son got real involved in roller hockey here in Visalia. My husband was running their youth hockey program. And he did that for about 3 years. And very suddenly, on September 25th, 2006, without any warning, my husband died. And I wasn't going to AA meetings, and I wasn't working with my sponsor, and I was not calling anybody. And somebody that we knew from hockey called me. I had plenty of support, but I wasn't sure what I was going to do, you know? So one of the guys who we knew, who my son played hockey with and my husband had coached, called me up and said, "You don't know this about me, but I know this about you. Your husband broke your anonymity. And I know that you're not going to meetings here, and I don't want you to drink over this, so I want you to come to a meeting with me." And I got back. I did. I didn't drink, and I stayed sober through it, and I started going back to meetings. And I got a sponsor, and I called my sponsor in a Roy Granny, and started working with her again. And I intensified my efforts in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I'd been praying all that time, and I'd been living the 10th, 11th, and 12th steps to the best of my ability. Actually, not the 12th steps so much, because I wasn't working with the other alcoholics. But I knew I needed to do something, and I think that was a wake-up call for me. And I don't know, you know, just even it made that decision to move to Visalia all that more just seemingly divinely inspired, because we financed our house in Visalia on my income, and all of a sudden it really, really was the only income we had and the only chance of income I had. Yeah. I just re-intensified my efforts at staying sober, and because I know that this program is what makes me feel living these steps and a relationship with a higher power, and doing everything I can to ask for his direction in the morning of his will for me, and asking him to give me the power to carry that out, is what makes me feel smart enough, pretty enough, and good enough. And I can't really express how grateful I am to Alcoholics Anonymous. I am truly convinced that it's a divinely inspired program, you know, and I am truly convinced that this program, these 12 steps, and living them to the best of my ability every day, is that little missing piece I had been missing all that time that led me finally to try to fill that missing piece with alcohol. And I don't always do it perfectly, and I don't always do it to the best of my ability even. But I do it. I get up. I suit up. I show up. And it's not always easy. Life hasn't always been easy for me. And I actually know in a lot of ways my life's been a lot easier than some others, you know. And this program taught me to look at that. Be grateful. To focus on the blessings. To not focus on things I wish were different. And when I focus on what's good in my life, it gets better. And when I focus on what's bad in my life, it gets worse. And it's a really simple program, but it's not always easy to do, you know. But I do know that for me, that's the one thing that I have a greater respect for those old-timers in that meeting in Minnesota. I do know for me that this is a life and death program. And just not drinking sometimes is all I can do. But then there's other times when I need to do more. You know, I need to continue to work with my sponsor, and I need to continue to live the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and continue to work with others, and that I can't rest on my laurels. I do firmly believe that I dodged a bullet about 3 years ago, that very well could have set me back out. It is the most painful thing, the most traumatic thing I've experienced in sobriety. You know, it just really is. But this program has walked me through a lot worse. It walked me through that death of my grandfather. My father died when I was sober. And I walked through that. I had my husband to walk through it with me, but I walked through it sober. And my mother, who used to hold the wastebasket and used to hold my hand and used to wipe the hair away, keep the hair away from my face while I was sicker than a dog, also died since I've been sober. And for me, that is proof that if I do continue to do what I'm doing by living the steps and working with the sponsor and being of service, sponsoring others, that I could very well stay sober for the rest of my life. I don't want to predict that, because really all I have is today. But I do know that this is the solution I've been searching for. I have a faith in a higher power today, and he works in my life when I ask for his will for me and the power to carry that out. And then I carry that out to the best of my ability. And for me, that's truly a miracle. And I'm very grateful to be sober today. And thanks for letting me share.
We do have just a couple of minutes. If anyone would like to ask a question, we'd be happy to take that now.
I'm Gilbert. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Gilbert.
I'm wondering, where's your sponsor's open? You left in the woods.
I never asked. I figured it wasn't my business. Maybe I should ask him. Anybody else? About 5 years. Yeah. It was short, but it was very, I don't know, I was one of those that it really didn't take very long to come to the conclusion that alcohol and I don't mix.
Okay, well, that's it then. Thank you, Ruth.
Thank you.